27 of the Chad New England podcast. I am Nick LaRock, and I'm sitting here on a beautiful Saturday morning after an ugly, ugly Celtics win last night. And I'm happy to say that I'm joined once again for the first time in a while by Ben Babcock. How are you, man?
I'm doing great. It's good to be back. I've missed the sound of your voice over the headphones, over the internet. It's been a fun little hiatus. You know, as you know, I've just celebrated the birth of our first son. So it's been exciting. It's been a little bit of a blur, but you know, it feels good to get grounded, to get back in the headset, back talking some professional sports with you.
So, are you guys on a full regiment of long snapping practice yet, or you know?
Well, I've been wanting to get in touch with you because the interesting development, at least in my experience so far, he's 1 month old yesterday, is that infants are fucking terrible at long snapping, man. Terrible. It's like,
are you sure it's not just that your infant sucks at it?
I'm pretty sure that they're all terrible at long snapping, but we're working on it. You pretty much have to shelf the proper hand technique, the snap count, all that stuff for a few months. Right now, what you're really working on is just wearing football-themed clothes. You know, like a little shirt that has a football on it. Those are kind of the fundamentals where you start right now. Maybe you put the draft on the television in the background, and you know, you let him sneak a few peeks at the TV. When the mom's not looking, you hope that he, you know, can at least make out the shapes and maybe some of the spatial relationships with the players in a 3-4 defense. You know, starts to understand the principles of lane responsibility. So, you know, you do what you can. You chip away. He's a very raw talent right now. But I think within a few months, we'll be out in the backyard, you know, working on the snaps, get the stopwatch out, you know, start to fine tune those things to where we need to be. But
so he's more of a project. He's not an NFL ready guy yet.
Definitely a projection is what they seem to call these guys now. But you know, he's got the tools. He's got big hands. I think he's going to be all right once he starts to develop a little bit more. But right now, certainly a project. I'd say he's probably in the seventh round to the undrafted free agent spectrum. So we've got a lot of work to do, but fortunately, you know, he's got a little bit of time before the 2036 draft. So we'll get there.
Good. So we're going to, last time we talked to you was, I believe, just the second week after the Super Bowl, and we were talking Saints bounties. Now, a lot's happened. So we're going to talk NFL offseason. Both of our teams have made some pretty big moves. Obviously, we had the NFL draft a couple of weeks ago, and that is an event that you and I have really enjoyed and embraced enthusiastically over the past 10 years. And so we're going to break down the draft. We'll talk a little off season. If we have some time, we'll get into the Saints bounties. We originally were thinking about discussing the whole Junior Seau and concussion issue, but after digging a little deeper into it, seems like we could do a better job if we push it off for a week or two and really sort of dig in. So we're gonna put that off. Obviously, there's no, you know, it's not an issue that's pressing. So we're just gonna focus on the off season today.
And I guess we would have to start with the defending world champions. You know, I guess that would be the proper thing to do.
Well, actually, I was just gonna say before we just get straight to the players, were you able to watch a lot of the draft or the first round, or how did it work out for you? Because I know you're busy.
Yeah, you know what? I actually did get to watch almost all of the draft. I was off of work for a few weeks there after we had the kid. So I was home, so it was very easy. My wife was very understanding. I convinced her that the NFL draft was an extremely important event, not something that just a guy who's maybe a little bit too obsessed with football would be into, but that was actually quite essential to the whole experience of following the team. So I did get to watch the entire draft. You know, I still don't like the Thursday night, Friday night thing with the draft, with the rounds being split up. And I really think that the NFL is, I understand what they're doing by moving it to prime time and trying to make it into this major event. But, I really miss the all day Saturday, all day Sunday, draft setup that they used to have. To me, being able to see, you know, the first few rounds unfold over one day was, you know, was much more enjoyable. Although this was an exciting first round, so that in and of itself was kind of nice to have it encapsulated in one night. You know, but I did get to watch most of the draft all the way until like the fifth or sixth round. And then I just followed the Patriots picks at that point. But
yeah, I'm with you. And I think, I don't like the idea of just having the one round on Thursday and then stopping, because I feel like that is just where it starts to get really interesting. And I feel, you know, I want more, and then I have to wait for a whole nother day. And I imagine it's got to be excruciating for some of the players, you know, some of the guys who are expecting to go in the first round, some of the guys that are holdovers in the green room, and then they're still not drafted. I mean, I don't know. I you know, who knows? I have no idea how this has shifted the ratings. And so I guess if it's making more money for the NFL, then, you know, more power to them. But anyways, just wondering. So, yep. Yeah, there's a lot of movers and shakers in the first round. I mean, do you think that with the new collective bargaining agreement, the fact that, you know, getting a guy in the top 10 picks is not such a high risk anymore? Do you think that that is maybe why we saw so many picks, so many teams trying to trade up in this draft? Or do you think it was just a top-heavy draft and, you know, some of the guys, because I've heard a lot of scouts say once you get past six or seven, there wasn't a lot of great talent in this draft?
Well, you know, I think it's a little bit of both. I felt like this was a very deep draft, and I thought there was a lot of skilled players being taken well into the second and third round, and even beyond, there were some guys that upon closer examination, you know, look like, you know, great, either great talents or great fits for a particular team. I was all for the readjustment of the rookie salary scale, because I believe that it was really, really hurting franchises to have to lock up so much money in, you know, the top 10 players or even the first round of the draft. Especially for a franchise that was already struggling and is going to be picking in that situation, to get so handcuffed to a particular player who may or may not pan out, I think it got completely out of whack when guys like Jamarcus Russell, you know, even Matthew Stafford, Sam Bradford, guys who are actually playing fairly well, the last two that are mentioned, but still the fact that they're commanding $50 million guaranteed contracts before even stepping on an NFL field is ridiculous. So I think that certainly helped convince teams to move up or made it the incentive to move up, or I guess the disincentive to move up was removed by the readjustment of the salary scale. And so I think that definitely was a factor. I also think there was definitely a lot of extremely talented players in this draft that filled, you know, serious needs. There was a lot of great secondary players in this draft. There were a lot of really good, strong defensive line players. And those are two holes that teams are always seeking to find difference makers for. So I think it was a little bit of both. And again, I think it was a great move by the NFL to restructure that rookie salary deal. I think it's going to help franchises a lot. The teams that are, you know, picking in those first five, six, seven, eight spots, they can't afford to be, you know, if they're that bad to begin with, where they're finishing in the bottom third of the league, they shouldn't be forced to, you know, either spend a huge fraction of their salary cap on one unproven player, and B, they shouldn't be forced to trade out of that spot, you know, or it shouldn't be kind of pressured to trade out of that spot because of the financial reasons, and miss out on a talented player that could really help the franchise. So I think it was good, but it was definitely exciting because it seemed like the last few years, especially last year, was so anticlimactic given the fact that the league was in a lockout and you knew that after the draft happened, basically nothing was going to happen, you know. So this year it just felt much more fluid. It was much more exciting. It really kind of felt like anything could happen at any given point. You knew the teams were going to make moves, whereas last year they were a lot more reluctant to get involved in trades, or they couldn't even trade players. So that eliminated that whole aspect of it. So, you know, I think that was a big part of it.
Yeah, and obviously we knew what was going on with the first and second picks. The Rams and Redskins had made that deal for the second pick a long time ago.
Do you like the idea that the teams could – I mean, it seems ridiculous that they wouldn't be able to, but do you think that a team should be able to come out and say, we're taking this guy with the number one pick? I mean, it seems like the league would not like that because it takes away a lot of the suspense and the theater of that first pick, you know?
Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, I don't think it really affects the, you know, I don't think like the sanctity of the event or anything is compromised, but at least if I'm the NFL, I hate that. And I know his name is escaping me at this moment, but the Colts owner, he tweeted out he put out on Twitter before it happened, you know, should we use the whole 5 minutes before we take Luck? And, you know, they've been putting it out there. And if I'm in charge, if I'm in the league office with the NFL, I hate that because I want everybody tuned in when this thing gets underway to see who the first pick is. And it's easy for us to say, oh, well, everyone knew it was going to be Luck. It was very clear. You know, first of all, I'm not even convinced for sure that Luck is better than RG3. I think they're both really good. I think they're both good quarterbacks. I guess Luck is the safer pick, but I've seen Robert Griffin make a lot more throws outside the numbers in college, deep throws, than I've seen Luck make. And, you know, that's what you need in the NFL. But, you know, if they're working out and nobody has said anything, there's been no peeps from anybody about who they're taking, I think more people are making sure that they're sitting down in front of the television when it happens. Because to me, this started at number three. And so I think in terms of the ratings and just in terms of, I agree with you, the suspense and the theater of the whole thing, which they're obviously trying to enhance by moving the event to Thursday night. Yeah, I'm with you. I think they got to keep it under wraps. And I remember, I mean, you want to talk about a draft that would have been crazy. I'm thinking, was it 2006 or was it 2007? I'm thinking the year Reggie Bush is coming out. So I think it was 2006. And I remember the night before that draft, as I was like going to bed, I see that the Texans had agreed to a deal with Mario Williams. And I was like, holy shit, that's crazy.
And that's the first time I remember that happening. I mean, there was always, I think, a sense of you knew what certain teams were going to do. But they came right out and announced, I think they even announced, like, the details of the contract and everything the night before. So it was like, here's the deal. It's a five-year deal worth X amount of dollars. So we'll see you guys at the beginning of round two.
Yeah,
you know?
And it's crazy because imagine, and in my mind, Reggie Bush was the pick, and for so many reasons. He's an explosive player, and just in terms of, like, jersey sales, endorsements, billboards all around Houston for a young team, it just seemed to make sense. And imagine sitting down and watching because you haven't heard anything, and then they take Mario Williams. That's crazy. That's
right.
I mean, that's almost like when you're watching a game and somebody makes a sick interception and runs it back for a touchdown. It's like just a total flip of what's going on. And I think that there's some sort of live drama there that can happen. And so, yeah, I do agree with you from just in terms of making it better for the fans. It would be a lot better if they treated these things with a little bit more security and secrecy for sure.
Right.
So this started at pick three. You and I talked a lot about this whole thing with Cleveland moving up for Trent Richardson. I don't think either of us are really in favor of it. I don't know if you've changed your mind a little bit.
No, it's one of those things where I think that in the last 20 years, let's say since from like the 90s, that was really, I think, the beginning of the end of the marquee one running back philosophy for NFL teams. You know, you had guys like Barry Sanders, you got guys like Ricky Waters, guys where it was clearly that they were going to get 30, 35 handoffs a game. And that was really it. They were on the field all three downs. You know, Emmitt Smith, Thurman Thomas, those kind of guys. And now as we've gone, you know, into the 21st century, you know, it's very rare. And then you look around the league and you see teams like, you know, Minnesota, Jacksonville, maybe, who are really doing it with one guy. But I don't think that because of the nature of the position, I just don't think it warrants, you know, a top 10 pick where there's so many talented guys out there who, given the right system and the right line in front of them, can have success in this league. And certainly we've seen that if you look at what the Denver Broncos have done, you know, over the last 15 years or so, and there was a stretch there where they were taking guys nobody had heard of and plugging them into their offense, and they were running for 1,500 yards, you know, one after another. It was almost a joke. Like, you could take anybody off the street, put them in Denver, and they could rush for 1,000 yards. I just don't see, you know, my philosophy on it, maybe I'm biased because this is sort of the way that the Patriots have done it, is that you can find a guy who maybe doesn't do everything at an extremely high level, but you can certainly find players who are great short yardage running backs. You can find a player who's a great, you know, breakaway speed running back. You can find a player who's a great receiving third down running back. And you can find players with those specific tool sets either through free agency or through the later rounds of the draft where your risk is much lower, and it really fits, I think, their value to your team much more appropriately. Whereas, you know, a franchise left tackle, a franchise defensive tackle, an elite cornerback, those are players I feel like it's much harder. You can't just plug any cornerback into a defensive system and have him excel in the same way that you can take a talented running back, put him on a great offense with a great offensive line, and have them succeed in the NFL. So, you know, and then you have to factor in the fact that there's also a lot of risk at that position. Knee injuries, lower body injuries, the fact that these guys who do take high workloads and get 25, 30 carries a game, they break down so much faster than players at almost any other position, I feel like. Whereas, you know, an offensive lineman that's taken high and is a franchise player, you can really expect him to have a productive 7, 8, 9, 10-year career in the NFL. With a running back, it's really much of more of a ticking time bomb sort of scenario where it's almost like the bigger role that he plays for you, the shorter his career and the more likelihood he is that he's going to fall off precipitously in a shorter period of time is. So, you know, I'm much more of a fan of taking a line player or a cornerback or a secondary player with those high picks. A running back to me doesn't make a lot of sense. And considering what, you know, I forget the exact details of the trade were to move up for that pick, but I don't agree with that philosophy.
Yeah, I'm totally on board with you. And, you know, the thing about it is, these guys have such short careers at the running back position. I mean, this was Adrian Peterson's fifth season.
Right.
And, you know, he's already been hurt a couple of times. This is a major injury he had this season. And so when you think about a team like the Browns, and you think about the fact that they've got so many holes, this is a team that is, I mean, they're not going to be competing for a while. And it just seems to me like you've got a great franchise tackle there that's available to you. You've got a franchise cornerback there who would end up going sixth. You've got a receiver that seems to be a pretty special talent that's available to you there. You've got great defensive linemen. It just seemed like there was a lot of opportunity there at that fourth pick that they had. That would allow them to sort of add depth and plug holes, because they've got holes all over their roster. While at the same time sort of setting themselves up, because I think it's so important with the draft that you're not thinking about next season. You're thinking about 5-6 years down the road. And with a running back, you know, especially like you said, the bigger workload you give them off the bat, the more of a load they're going to be expected to carry, the shorter that career is going to be. And so to me, it just seemed like a risky pick. And it's not even just staying pat. It's not even just staying pat and making the trade. It's trading up to make that trade, to me, just seems really, really questionable.
Yeah, I mean, I just forgot what I was going to say. But yeah, I think, now I remember. I feel like the fall off between maybe the top three running backs in a draft class to numbers 3 through 10, I would speculate that there's really less difference between those two groups of players in terms of how they project and to their productivity in the NFL than really maybe at any other position in the league, because so much of what they do depends upon the blocking scheme in front of them and the talent of the guys on the line. I mean, they really need a solid offensive unit in order for them to function in a productive way, you know, just like a quarterback needs the pieces around them. But you know, you take a top five draft talented defensive lineman, you can put him on any defensive line in the league and he's going to be effective. You know, I don't see how it justified the third pick in the draft. He's an incredible running back, an incredible talent, but is there really that much difference between him and the kid from Boise State if they're both on the same team? You know, if they're both on an equally talented team, I don't think so. You know, so you know, I guess we'll have to wait and see how it pans out. But it's boring. People get upset when teams like, they just pick a tackle. Like, it's not that exciting. The highlights that they show of these guys playing don't get the average casual fan excited. You know, nobody wants to see, you know, just solid footwork and a pass drop where a guy just gets in the way of somebody else preventing a sack. Like, this is not exciting television. They want to see somebody run over somebody. They want to see an amazing catch. But, you know, that's not how the game is won, I don't think, at the NFL level. I think you got to have those strong core guys. I could see reaching for a quarterback if you need it, but to reach for a running back, that to me is just, I don't think it's the best use of that pick.
Yeah, and, you know, they gave up. For Minnesota, it's a great deal because Minnesota was going to take Ryan Khalil either way.
Right.
And they got three extra picks on the third day. And, you know, it's easy for people to laugh that off and say, well, whatever, they gave up three picks on the third day. Who are those guys going to be? Well, and the answer is that those guys are going to be filling out depth on your roster. Those guys are going to be playing special teams. And 3 or 4 years down the road, those guys are going to be hopefully making valuable contributions to your team if you do your job correctly. And so, you know, so the draft goes on. So I guess we'll start with the Giants. And the reason I brought up Trent Richardson is just that you and I had talked about the, you know, I trust Jerry Reese completely. He's done a great job drafting, and we've gone through all of the examples of that. He took a running back at pick number 32, David Wilson out of Virginia Tech. And, you know, to me, this is a place where you can really get behind taking a running back. You know, you look at Wilson on the film, he's a really explosive guy. He's got a low center of gravity. And he's a guy who is still able to run guys down 15, 20 yards down the field. He's got a great burst to hit the hole, and then he's able to accelerate once he's in the open field. You know, the scouting report says that he doesn't catch the ball real well, but, you know, everything I've seen, it looks to me like he can be effective in that way. And it seems to me like this guy is, you know, has the potential to be a real weapon for them. And, you know, I think he could make just as big an impact as Richardson does. You know, the difference is the Giants are taking him at 32 rather than 3.
Right. And that's where the value is for running back is end of the first round, second and third round. But, you know, he looks good. You know, like you said, he's a guy who can contribute on special teams. And looks like he'll be a good fit in that offense. And, you know, he's going to a situation where he doesn't have to carry the load. You've got Ahmad Bradshaw. You got a couple of the other guys that you have in that backfield. Obviously, losing Brandon Jacobs might have been a factor, although the Giants are one of those teams that kind of notoriously draft best available as opposed to positional need. Although it seems like maybe that just it just kind of worked out that way with their draft this year, because they did end up filling a lot of spots that they just lost guys in free agency from.
Yeah, that's an interesting factor here is that, you know, they do always say that they draft, as you said, four best player rather than need. And that's frustrated me at times. For example, I was frustrated when they took Jason Pierre-Paul because they had him as the best player on their board. And to me, that was a position that we already were pretty well filled out and we had other needs. I really wanted us to take a linebacker. But, you know, of course,
it's worked out pretty well.
Yes, sitting where I am right now, that seems like the smart pick. You know, according to them, Wilson's who they wanted there. There's been a lot of speculation from people that they would have taken Doug Martin from Boise State if Tampa Bay hadn't traded up to get Martin at 31. Jerry Reese hasn't said that. Jerry Reese has said, we had Wilson ahead of Martin on our board. If Martin had been available at 32, we would have taken Wilson instead. You know, of course, if that wasn't the case, he's never going to admit that.
Right.
Because there's no benefit that can come from him admitting that. So I think a lot of people just had Martin ranked a lot higher than Wilson. But you and I have a guy on the inside, and we've gotten some pretty in-depth NFL scouting reports on all of these guys. So I've got, I've got reports from several different franchises on Wilson. I got about 15 pages of scouting on him. And, you know, they all say the same thing. They all say this is a guy who, if there's a hole there, he hits the hole extremely fast. That, like I said, once he's in the open field, he's a physical runner and he can make guys miss. He's got the speed to get open out of the backfield, and even though he does have questionable hands at times, he's made a lot of big plays catching the ball. Blocking is going to be an issue, and of course, Ahmad Bradshaw is the best pass blocking running back in the league, and so, you know, hopefully he'll be able to take Wilson under his wing there. And if Bradshaw's already come out and said that he's going to make Wilson his project, getting him to be NFL ready, but you know, a lot of the character stuff that's in these reports, and it's hard to sort of parse out what stuff is useful and what stuff isn't useful. But you know, they all say this is a guy who has an extremely strong work ethic. This is a guy who he wore a coat and tie to class at Virginia Tech every single day. He carried a 2.9 GPA, which is, you know, pretty respectable when you consider how much time these guys have to devote to football. You know, football is basically a full-time job for them. And another little tidbit for you is that he once caught a rabbit on the practice field while wearing his coat and tie.
Well, that is useful information for the front office to have when making a running back pick.
To be fair, I mean, there's all these reports about the Pahokee, Florida, right? This is a sugarcane town. That's where Janoris Jenkins is from and Fred Taylor and lots of other NFL guys. And this is like an NFL factory, and it's because these guys are chasing rabbits all around the cane fields all the time because they're nearly impossible to catch. So when I saw that in the scouting report, that made me pretty happy. But they all say this guy is a leader. He's extremely enthusiastic. He's very outspoken. It seems to me like the Giants are getting not only a weapon, but they're also getting a guy who's going to work extremely hard, a guy who's going to take pretty well the coaching. And so I'm pretty excited about that pick, but the thing that excites me the most about this draft is who the Giants got at number two. And that is because this guy, Reuben Randall, and if you watch college football at all this year, you should know who he is, wide receiver for LSU, number two. The Giants were really thinking about taking him, with that number 32 pick. He was invited to the draft. He was in the green room. You know, this is a guy who played at LSU and had great numbers for 2 years despite having subpar quarterback play. This is a guy who, when I listened to the NFL Today podcast the day after the first round, you know, I heard Matt Williamson, the ESPN scout, mentioning Randle as a guy that several teams, including the 49ers, maybe should have taken over the guys that they did take. And so I had heard on lots of different Giants sites that this is who they were going after. And sure enough, he's still there when they're picking at 32 in the second round, last player left in the green room. And so the Giants were really able to get the two guys who they had on their board for that 32nd pick at 32 and 64. And I think Randle is a guy that's going to be able to step right in for Mario Manningham.
Yeah, that seems like a good, that seems like a good fit. And again, you were, I remember, you know, we texted prolifically during the draft. We're very, very excited about this pick. And he does look like he's a pro-ready receiver. You know, obviously anybody who played, I think, either at Alabama or LSU basically was playing on a professional team. I think probably a certain units on those two college teams were better than some of the units in the pro when you look at offenses and defenses. So that looks like a good fit, and again, it fills the hole of the Mario Manningham departure. So a nice pickup there. You know, another good value pick, a guy who maybe dropped a little bit.
This guy's listed at 6'4", okay, and I've seen 6'2", I've seen 6'4". Obviously, it's, you know, if you see that, it's probably more in the neighborhood of 6'2", 6'3". But he ran a 4'4". You know, he's a big, strong guy. He, you know, Jerry Reese said he's a guy who they think can run the entire route tree, can run all the different routes that you're going to be looking for. These scouting reports we have talk about him. He doesn't have world beater speed. You know, this is not Randy Moss running down the field. But at a 4-4, he runs at a good clip, and he runs really strong routes. He's really good out of the breaks. You know, the one big issue he has, and I don't know if this is why he fell so far, because that's the first thing to me is, you know, you say you got the last guy out of the green room in round two. You know, at the time, to me, that was all positive. That was like, this is money. We just got a huge value pick. Then, you know, of course, a couple days later, when you start thinking a little more realistically, questions start popping into your mind. Why was this guy still there? What do I not know yet? He's not very good at adjusting to the ball when it's in the air. And you and I, we looked at that video, and you were saying you thought it was interesting that he made all these big plays against Florida, and one, but they had the play in there where he ran down the field and would have had a sure touchdown, but he couldn't adjust to the ball, right, and he didn't score. you know, but I would say a couple things. A, as I said, he's playing with a very poor quarterback at LSU, or quarterbacks, I should say.
Right, not even with a consistent signal caller.
Right. He also so he's going to have Eli Manning now, and Eli Manning has a reputation for getting those receivers in the offseason, working around the clock, extra time with them, watching film, running routes with them. You know, so he's going to be on the same page with Eli, hopefully. The other thing is that, you know, Nix and Cruz are your real burners down the field. I know Manningham made the long catch in the Super Bowl, but, you know, they're not going to be asking him to run those. He's going to be running more intermediate routes, and given the size of his frame, given the way he's able to run those, I think they should be able to plug him in. You know, when you look at the report, what you do see are that this is a guy who a lot of people are saying could work harder. This is a guy who sat out a lot of practices because he had tendonitis in his knees, and they were even saying the quarterbacks, in a way, were glad to have him gone so that they could have someone that was practicing every week to work on their timing. You know, but I would say a couple things. I would say, one, he's got competition right now. This is a guy that was the number one recruit in the country coming out of high school. And now he's got competition with Jarrell Jernigan for that third spot. The Giants have done a really good job of building some depth there. And I think that that's really going to push him to improve. And I don't know. Those things I always feel like might be a little overblown. I feel like the scouts are maybe digging a little bit too much so that, you know, because you're going to be paying this guy a lot of money. So,
right,
you know, if Reese felt okay about it, then I'm certainly on board.
You're on board. So, you know, looking at the rest of the picks for the Giants here, one guy that really jumped out to me, I'm skipping ahead just a little bit, is this tight end out of Cincinnati, Adrian Robinson. Not a guy that I'd ever heard of, but when they listed some of, you know, his physical attributes, his speed numbers. He obviously is one of those guys who's going to be a little bit of a project, but man, he looks like a physical freak. And I think Reese has even come out and said that he's a little bit of like a JPP clone at the tight end position.
Yeah, that's exactly what he said. He said, we just got the JPP of tight ends.
Right. So, I mean, that's gotta have you excited. And again, tight end was a position that, you know, you felt like the Giants really needed to address in the offseason. This guy's raw, but, I mean, he certainly looks like somebody with huge upside given, you know, his athletic ability.
Yeah, I think it's a great pick. I mean, you know, I'm really excited about the first four picks they had, and he was the fourth one. And like you said, this is a guy that jumps. You know who he reminds me of actually is when the Patriots drafted Ben Watson, a guy who's a little bit unproven still, but athletically he just jumps off the page of you when you read through his stuff. Sounds right. Like he's a kid that works really hard. Sounds like he's really raw. He's got all the athletic tools. And when you think about guys that haven't played football their whole lives, but, you know, Ben Watson is an example of a guy who stepped in and was successful there. Antonio Gates is another example of a guy.
Jimmy Graham
to do that.
Would
Jimmy
be the
right.
I mean, look at what he did.
Yep, Jimmy Graham, another example. You know, so that is, you know, in the fourth round, that's the perfect time to roll the dice on a pick like that. They had two fourth-round picks. He was the earlier one. Like I said, like you said, he's got all the tools. He's got all the physical ability. And if any quarterback is going to be able to bring him along and really get him to the point where he can make an impact maybe next year or the year after, I think it's Eli Manning. You know, they also address this position by going out and getting Martellus Bennett from the Cowboys. And I love that move because Bennett is a great – he's a great, great run blocker. He's a guy who I think can be – also a big weapon in the passing game. He was stuck behind Jason Witten in Dallas, so we didn't really get to see what he could do. So, you know, they've addressed that need in multiple ways to the point where now I almost feel like, you know, it's not just an area of need anymore. It's an area of strength. I mean, we've got, you know, two guys who contributed last year who will be coming back. We've got Martellus Bennett, who, again, I think can step in and be a really solid starter. And, you know, now we've got this guy who, you know, if he's able to, you know, to make good on his potential, could be a star in this league. So, I think the Giants did a great job. You know, they only took two offensive linemen, and that's the big complaint a lot of fans have is, you know, the offensive line was a real concern last year. But, you know, I would say Dave Deal and Chris Knee both had, you know, worse years than we're accustomed to seeing, and they both needed to have offseason surgery. But Kareem McKenzie is gone, and I think – you know, we've got Kevin Booth, we've got Mitch Petras who are stepping in well. And you know what? The truth of the matter is, and it's important to have a strong offensive line and defensive line, but the offensive line is not quite as important as it used to be in this league we have now, this passing league. No team gave up more pressures, more quarterback pressures than the Giants last season, and yet the Giants won the Super Bowl. So that right there should tell you something.
Yeah, I mean, that's an impressive stat, and you look at what Eli was able to do in those situations. You know, we talked about going into the season that offensive line was going to be really a question mark for this team. Obviously, given the number of injuries that you guys suffered at the beginning of the season, you could have had question marks in a lot of places. Secondary is one that jumps out to me as well. So, you know, I think the Giants did a great job adding guys who will contribute now, but I think they also did a nice job with a couple project players and a lot of depth guys, which is a nice luxury to have when you have a successful team, you know, and some really really strong units, particularly a defensive line, you know, and they're doing some things to fortify the offensive line. So, I mean, overall, if you had to give the draft a grade, how do you feel that the Giants did this year?
I love what they did. You know, I'm gonna give it a B minus, just because I think, you know, when we're looking at it, I think that David Wilson is kind of a luxury pick. He's a weapon, and you know, you need to have guys like that to be successful in this league. But you know, he's far from he's far from the sure thing that you can get by drafting, you know, a blue chip offensive or defensive lineman in the top 15. You know, so because they're at 32, they're not, they're, you know, there's no sure things left at that point. You know, but the fact that they went offensive skill player at the first two picks is questionable to me. But again, I think they got good value, especially with the Randall pick. I think they had to make it. And I think that if those guys are able to contribute, that they're going to be real successful. And then after that, I mean, I love, you know, they addressed the secondary, they addressed the offensive line. There's a lot of potential here. And I think that when you look at the way the Giants are built in the place where they were picking, you know, I think this is a draft that I at least feel like they're going to hit on at least two of these guys. And if that, yep, if they do that, then I think that's good. And that's about as good as you can hope for picking at 32. Last thing, two things quick. One is that the Giants linebacker, of course, has been an area of weakness for them. They're a team that really likes to focus on building the D-line and the secondary. They traded away a fifth pick for Keith Rivers from Cincinnati, a guy who was a ninth overall pick in 2008. This is a move that I love. I just feel like this is a guy who's had injury problems. I feel like coming in, getting a fresh start, this is a guy that I think can make really valuable contributions. And, you know, at the fifth pick, worst case scenario, you know, he doesn't come back and you know, our guy, Jonathan Goff, was penciled in to be our original starting middle linebacker last year. Then, obviously, he got hurt for the year, and we were able to patch it well enough to win the Super Bowl. But Goff just signed with the Washington Redskins, so that's a place where we need to. It was a hole that was there. So I think bringing in Keith Rivers, adding him to the linebacking core is a nice move for them. And the other thing, did you see the email that I sent you about what that scouting report said about Reuben Randall and why he went to LSU?
I don't think I did. You're going to have to refresh our memory for the...
I hope it's not inappropriate to share. I just will, whatever. When do we ever worry about appropriate? But one of the scouting reports I read from one of the teams basically said, this guy was all set to go play at Oklahoma, and then his dad is a preacher, and it said, and then suddenly his dad's church had a new roof and like a new side porch or something, and he was going to LSU.
Huh, that's kind of a coincidence, don't you think?
Yeah, I think so.
It's a miracle.
Yeah. So let's talk Patriots here. Patriots, notorious for not using first-round picks, notorious for trading down in the draft, notorious for underwhelming their fans on draft day. And when the fans complain about it, that there's a lack of blue chip talent on the roster, everyone, you know, gets in the argument where we always have people saying, oh, Belichick knows what he's doing. He's a genius. Belichick knows what he's doing. And that's what I was expecting. And instead, we got the total opposite of that.
That was what I was expecting as well. You know, you have to, over the years, as a fan of the Patriots, you need to program yourself to not expect anything exciting whatsoever when it comes to the NFL draft. And you know, so the draft was the day after the Bruins had just been eliminated from the Stanley Cup playoffs. My post on my Facebook page was that, you know, nothing takes a sting off a Game 7 loss like trading down out of the first round. And that was totally what I was expecting the Patriots to do. Obviously, like we talked about at the beginning, this draft was a little bit different. There was a lot more mobility in the first round than we've seen in the last few years. I still was not expecting the Patriots to move up, and they did. They started the day with the 27 and 31st picks. They ended up moving up twice. The first one, they moved up to pick 21 to take Chandler Jones out of Syracuse, a defensive end, which is another surprise for Patriots fans, because for the last 4 or 5 years, we've really been hoping that this team would be able to address the issue with pass rush, which has been something that this team has struggled with. They haven't had a playmaking defensive lineman since they let Richard Seymour go to the Raiders. And the pass rush is something that has really hurt this team defensively, especially last year where you look against the pass, they were one of the worst teams in the league, if not the worst. They were one of the bottom two or three. And they really did not get after the quarterback. Chandler Jones is a guy who is physically, you know, a big, lanky, long, fast, athletic guy, sort of in the mold of a Pierre Paul type player. I don't think athletically as gifted per se, but somebody who kind of projects to be that sort of player for the Patriots. You know, a guy who can rush the passer, and will be a little bit of a project, but somebody who obviously the Patriots felt highly about, enough to move up to select him. And this is something, you know, where the Patriots, yes, they've traded down a lot, but they have, when they have gone after players in the first round of the draft, they've had a ton of success. Jerod Mayo being one of those guys, Solder, the tackle out of Colorado, who will probably be their starting left tackle this year now that Matt Light is retired. So Belichick has done especially well in the first round with his talent. So that has me very excited that they like this guy enough to move up and get him, and that he really addresses a position that this team has been struggling to find players to fit and be productive. So that's an exciting pick. Just as exciting for me is – or did you have a question about that?
I was just going to tell you. So I was excited that a guy from Cuse was in the first round because, you know, I'm a Big East basketball fan.
Yep.
And so this guy is Union Endicott High School in New York. That's where he went to high school. And his high school coach came out and said that he's going to be going, Chandler Jones is going to be going for 15 sacks this season. That's his goal.
Well, I mean, that would be probably 14 more than anybody had last year for the Patriots, from what it seems. I mean, we had Andre Carter and Mark Anderson who were fairly effective, but those are guys who are sort of in the twilight of their career. Really, you know, we're really looking for an explosive playmaker, and Jones should be able to be that. I mean, he's got he's one of those guys you look at, like, you know, you could say like the great bloodline, like Gronkowski. He's got two brothers in the league. There's a few other families like that. His older brother is an MMA fighter, a guy named Bones Jones. And his other older brother is a defensive end for the Baltimore Ravens. And he's the youngest of the three. So, you know, I'm thinking we may have a little bit of the that Eli Manning younger brother thing going on, where he's just been, you know, he's had his ass kicked basically for 24 years from these older brothers who are tough guys in their own right. And hopefully that's really kind of chiseled him into just like an angry, tough, smart guy who's not going to back down from anybody. You know,
yeah.
That's one of my thoughts.
Yeah, and NFL.com, they said exactly what you said. They said, think Jason Pierre-Paul part two.
Yeah. So, and, I mean, know, the Patriots should be aware of what a guy like that can do, having just lost to the Giants in two straight Super Bowls. Having to block a player with that type of athleticism, that type of skill set, you know, you can't help but think that that may have played a part in their decision, saying, you know what, we need to get a player like this guy, because that's the kind of player that can really disrupt an offense, can really make a lot of plays defensively. They found a guy who they think might be able to fit that type of role, who they can develop, and they went up and got him. And that's, you know, that's got to be exciting for Patriots fans. The second guy who they moved up to get is just as exciting to me, because this guy, I was just watching some of his highlights again online before we connected here this afternoon, and that's Dante Hightower, linebacker out of Alabama. And like I was saying earlier in the conversation, that, you know, Alabama, LSU, those are essentially professional teams for all intents and purposes. And especially if you look at Alabama and how many players were drafted off of that team in the first round this year, it was like six or seven guys. It's almost incredible. And then you throw an Upshaw at the beginning of the second round. Pretty incredible level of talent at that college. Hightower is an exciting, explosive player. He played inside at Alabama. A lot of people were projecting him as a Mike linebacker in a 4-3 NFL defense. The Patriots are pretty strong inside with Spikes and Mayo, but I think Hightower will fit in. I think he's going to play immediately. I think he can play outside. If you watch his highlights, he moves all over the field, rushes from the edge quite a bit. He blitzed off the edge a lot. Really could hold his own against offensive tackles. He's the guy who called all the defenses for the front seven in Alabama. He may be coming to the Patriots from a better defense in a lot of ways. Alabama might have had a better defense last year than the Patriots did.
I mean, they're going to have a lot of guys that are going to be on the field in the NFL next year. So,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at those players, the secondary, some of the defensive line, maybe not as strong as it has been in the past, but certainly the linebackers in the secondary off that Alabama team
Sergio Brown would not have sniffed the field at Alabama.
Sergio Brown shouldn't be sniffing anything this season except, you know, Chipotle, because that guy doesn't need to be on the field for the Patriots anymore, I'm hoping. You know, Hightower, I'm very excited about. I think he's going to be a franchise-type linebacker in this league for a long time, hopefully, with the Patriots. It was crazy because it was like, I'm waiting for the other shoe to drop. I'm waiting for them to draft a quarterback or another tight end or some position where you would look at their roster and you would say, they really don't need this guy, you know, and that's one of the things that you obviously can relate to, being frustrated by this best available philosophy. And maybe it was just the way that the Patriots had their board, but they went with free safety in round two. Kid out of Illinois who looks like, you know, he's a big, physical, athletic free safety, not one of the highest rated safeties in the draft by a lot of people. I know that there was another team in the AFC East who will not be mentioned who lists him as a do not draft, will not be a fit in our NFL defense. But he's a guy who moved around quite a lot for Illinois, played in the box a lot, was originally a cornerback, so has some flexibility there, and I think that'll be a good piece for the Patriots, a guy that they can move either from the safety position to maybe a nickel linebacker, maybe use him outside as a cornerback in a cover two type defense. A big physical guy, knows for the football. Another need for this team. The Patriots had been rumored as thinking of trading up for Mark Barron, being willing to part with both of their first round picks to move up to take him as high as 9. I think he ended up going 7th, 6th or 7th to Tampa Bay. Let me just check that. Yeah, he went 7. Yeah, he went 7 to Tampa Bay.
So I know Claiborne went 6th. So.
Right. So that they were in conversation to move up and grab him. Obviously, if Tampa Bay hadn't got him, they probably could have had him at 9 since Miami was going with the quarterback there. Which, again, was another pick that we thought was ludicrous. But that being aside, this was, I thought, the biggest weakness of the Patriots' defense last year was free safety play. Obviously, Brandon Merriweather was gone before the season, released. I thought that, you know, Merriweather probably wasn't the guy for them at free safety, but they took a huge step back when they were bringing in guys like Sergio Brown, Josh Barrett. They had some injuries back there. They never found a guy to play back there. And I think that was probably the thing that hurt their secondary the most, and especially players like Devin McCourty and Kyle Arrington, was that they didn't have a consistently high level of play over the top. And in a lot of cases, that left the cornerbacks exposed in a lot of the coverages that the Patriots play, which they play a lot of under coverages. They play a lot of trail techniques with those guys. They had no help over the top whatsoever. So hopefully Wilson is a guy who is able to come in and play, or maybe they can shuffle guys around now that they have another flexible defensive back on their team. And then the third round, you know, they go out and they take another defensive end, the guy from Arkansas, Jake Beckett, who, you know, obviously the one knock on Jones that I think a lot of people will have is that he played in the Big East and it's not the highest level of talent. Whereas a guy like Beckett coming out of Arkansas, he's been playing in the SEC, which is probably the best football conference in the country. He's a high motor guy to get after the quarterback. Again, a nice piece, you know, really addressing a need. We'll see if we'll throw these two guys at that problem, the pass rush issue, the edge player issue, see if one of them can stick. I loved the first four picks. I thought they were all needs of this team. They addressed the defense. They addressed the defense front seven. They did address an issue in the secondary. So it was great. You know, and then they were kind of out of the game there. They ended up actually trading out of the third round with their second, third round pick to Green Bay, and then trading out of the fifth round again. They wind up with three picks in the sixth and seventh round. The sixth round pick, which is an interesting one, this guy, Nate Ebner from Ohio State, I don't know if you know anything about him, but he's actually one of the best collegiate rugby players in the country.
Really?
He's listed as a safety, but he walked onto the Ohio State team, played special teams, strictly special teams for them for the last year or two, but is one of the top college rugby players in the country. I went to look for highlights of him on YouTube, and I started getting all these rugby highlights. I was like, oh, it must be a guy with the same name. But it's not. It's this guy who's an amazing rugby player and walked on to the Ohio State football team and basically was a gunner on punt teams, was on the kickoff teams. And, I mean, he could flat out fly. He's real raw. He only has a couple years of organized football under his belt. But, you know, if you're looking at a guy to fulfill a special teams role, it's a pretty interesting pick. I'm curious to see how he's going to fit because, again, I'm not sure how much value he has actually in a traditional defensive setting, but as a special teams player, he could have an incredible value. It was just kind of a quirky pick. You know, I don't think there was a lot of teams with this guy on their board. It was kind of an interesting pick. And then in the seventh round, I'm looking at these two guys in the seventh round, man, and I tell you what, I think that both of these guys are going to make the team, and I think that both of these guys are going to be productive. And, you know, it's not something you can always say about a seven-round pick, but I think that the two guys that they got in this round, one is Alfonso Denard, cornerback out of Nebraska, who played alongside Prince Amukamara in that defensive backfield there. Is a guy who's going to compete for playing time on this team within the next year or two. And then they pick up a guy out of Northwestern, a slot receiver named Jeremy Ebert, who looks a lot like Wes Welker, Julian Edelman, a little bit bigger than those guys, but just the same 4.4 speed, great hands, smart player, you know, really the perfect player for the Patriots system. The numbers are tough at wide receiver for the Patriots this year. There's a lot of players in that position right now, but he's a guy who could return kicks, play special teams, so that gives him a little bit more value. And Denard, I think, was an extremely highly rated cornerback coming into this year, has a lot of off-the-field issues. I think he was arrested for assaulting a police officer a few days before the draft. So, you know, that's a good way to fall far down the draft board right there. I think the Patriots stole these two guys out of the seventh round. So I'm sort of excited for them.
So speaking of, well, I got two questions. I guess I'll start with the less serious one first. The assaulting a police officer, reading through these reports, it's really interesting, all of the things that sort of make it into these reports. And I don't know, like, I wonder, like, this guy assaulted a police officer, right? So, like, that's a legitimate concern about his decision-making because you don't want your players in legal trouble, right? Exactly. And, like, a guy like Janoris Jenkins, who is supremely talented but fell to round three because, you know, he's been arrested and tasered by police and all kinds of things.
And, you know, it's interesting because the Patriots, I know, had Janoris Jenkins as a do-not-draft on their board. So he was not even an option for them at all at any point in the draft. But then they go out and draft this guy who was arrested a couple days before the draft.
We had some reports on Jenkins, and so this is what I guess I mean of, like, what does it? Because, like, with Jenkins, we did see things in some of the reports about, like, him, for example, getting in arguments with the trainers at North Alabama and just, like, no longer speaking to them and not being treated by the trainers anymore because he wouldn't speak to them. And I wonder if things like that, and keep in mind, that's his, like, now I'm really on thin ice. I just went from being a star for the Florida Gators. Now I play at North Alabama. And he's causing those. So do you think with him it's, like, maybe more even the fact that he's causing dissent in the locker room and with team employees than it is the fact that he's been arrested? I don't know.
I think it's obvious that there's a different threshold for players with off the field issues within each organization around the league, right? Like, so like there's things I think that, that some coaches would maybe accept that other ones would not. And I think a lot of it depends on past history with players with issues. Some guys have been burned by these guys before. Other guys have had some level of success. Some guys have had great levels of success with players with off the field issues. I think a lot of what had to do with the Patriots removing Jenkins from their board list is the relationship that Belichick has with Urban Meyer, who's the coach of Florida at the time, who kicked him off the team. A lot of this was, and again, this was a player who a lot of people thought would be a good fit for the Patriots. One, because the secondary was such an issue. Two, because he would be a player who would presumably fall to the lower rounds or be selected at a slot that was well below his potential or his athletic ability, which ended up being the case where he was taken in the third round. So
yeah,
a lot
actually,
of people,
I misspoke actually. It was round two. I apologize.
Round two, whatever. Same idea though. He was a guy who was, you know, legitimately considered a top 10 talent, a guy who could be talked about in the same breath as a Morris Claiborne or a Dre Kirkpatrick. But you know, he's down in the second round. You know, and here's the thing though, man, because like everybody's like, oh, so he's selected by the Rams, now coached by Jeff Fisher, and everybody's making a big deal about like, oh, well, Jeff Fisher, he worked with Albert Haynesworth. He was able to have success with Albert Haynesworth. He had Pac-Man Jones in Tennessee. He had some success with Pac-Man Jones. I mean, define success with a player like those guys. You know, is having a player perform well for a year or two and then just going completely batshit crazy and going off the deep end and doing nothing, is that a success with a first or second round draft pick? Like, was Jeff Fisher really successful with Albert Haynesworth because he basically, he was suspended. He still had all those issues. Like, yeah, he played as the best football of his NFL career when he was with Jeff Fisher. But I mean, what do you really say about a guy like Haynesworth, his career? What do you say about his career now? I mean, he was cut from two teams last year. Pac-Man Jones, the same thing. Like, it was the Pac-Man Jones experiment really a success? I mean, aren't you always waiting for something terrible to happen? I mean, what's an example of a guy with this high profile of off the field issues being drafted and becoming a consistent high level player with a good track record of behavior and whatnot in the league for an extended period of time?
Yeah, no,
it seems like these things always catch up with a player, you know, at a certain point. You know, there's a difference between a guy who's been caught smoking weed or has maybe one or two issues, you know, partying too much, maybe one arrest for something like that. But like when you look at a guy who's been kicked off of a college program, where I'm going to go out on a limb and say, if you're as talented as he is purported to be, it's got to be pretty hard for you to be kicked out of the University of Florida. You know,
yeah,
when you're competing, when you're competing for a national title, and really that's, you know, at that level in that conference of football, I mean, when you're competing against the LSUs and the Alabamas of the world, you want every edge that you can get at any possible cost, you know, and we've certainly seen plenty of evidence of that. But you know, it's like, why?
Yeah.
Why is the risk really worth it? And I think for a lot of teams, the answer is no. St. Louis had a lot of picks in the middle round, so they had a little bit of luxury to take a chance on a player like him who could potentially be a difference maker. You know, maybe he cleans up his act. You know, I wish him all the best. I don't want to see anybody fail in particular, but, you know, but it is. There's a line that some coaches will cross. Obviously Jeff Fisher would, but Bill Belichick wouldn't, you know? So, and some of those things, it's like, what's worse, you know, multiple arrests for drug possession or a handgun charge? Is domestic assault worse than, just, you know, I don't know, a traffic violation or repetitive traffic violations or something like that, you know?
Right. There's also the issue of like multiple arrests, but this kid loves football, works really hard, is a great teammate, is a great leader.
Yes.
versus like this guy, clean record off the field, doesn't drink, doesn't use drugs. Doesn't seem, I mean, we saw a ton of guys who were first, second round picks in those reports, and the scouts flat out said, doesn't seem that passionate about football, does not seem like a great leader, you know, could work a lot harder in practice. And, like, how much do you weigh those two factors? Because one guy who was originally supposed to go in the first round was Cordy Glenn, and he's a guy who we saw, I don't know if you read the report on him, but it was a lot of, like, underachiever.
Yep.
Even though he's respected by his teammates, he could work a lot harder, doesn't seem that passionate about football. And he was picked two picks after Janoris Jenkins.
Right. You know, and again, it's such a subjective thing when you read the scouting reports. And you have to consider that, you know, and I'm sure we can both relate to being on teams and the relationship between a certain player and a coach just isn't there, even though, you know, maybe the players around him see this guy's ability or his potential, for whatever reason, doesn't click with the coach. The coach doesn't give him the playing time that he needs, maybe doesn't think so highly of him. And you have to factor that into the fact that, scouts and the personnel from the pro teams are calling these coaches up and they're saying, you know, what can you tell me about this guy? You know, and the coach isn't going to have a great relationship with every one of his players. And, you know, in order to protect his reputation, he's going to maybe say, you know, be willing to say, you know, well, I guess if I was really pressed, I would say the one thing about this guy that I don't necessarily like is that, you know, he doesn't really study film or, you know, something like that. And it may be completely mundane and it may be irrelevant. And like you said, I think a lot of times these scouts are really digging to find any possible, you know, issue or potential problem that they can, just, you know, really to give their organization the broadest possible picture of this person's character, his abilities, his defects, whatever the case may be.
It is
fascinating. It's a fascinating exercise in psychology to examine, you know, these personnel reports, watch where these guys fall, and then kind of track their success once they get into the pro level.
Yeah, I mean, we had a guy we read about who was a pretty high pick who, you know, I mean, they're talking a lot in the report about him being too overly affectionate with his mother.
Which blew both our minds. I mean, yeah, you would think that would be completely irrelevant, but...
And that, yeah, he had dressed up like a cat for Halloween, and you know what's funny, it's like, it doesn't seem like that matters, but then when he got drafted, you and I were both looking for his mom to see what she looked like, and we were like, oh man, I hope they know that he, like, is really affectionate with his mom, and we're like, what, like, why is that, you know, and like,
nothing is sacred, nothing is private, this is the world that we live in now,
and you have to think, when he was drafted, I mean, it wasn't just us, there must have been 1,000 people around the world watching, thinking the same thing in their mind, like, yep, oh, he's a little overly touchy with his mom. You know what I mean?
Like is there going to be an open mouth kiss now, or like, when the camera doesn't pan away too quickly?
Yeah, welcome to the NFL, young man. You're going to be under a microscope for the next 10 years. So I guess my other question on the Patriots is, his name is escaping me at the time, Chandler Jones.
Yes.
He seems like the prototypical 4-3 defensive end to me. And I guess the big question people are asking is, what are the Patriots going to be doing? Because it seems like they've got a pretty stacked linebacker core now. But it seems like those are all some pretty heavy linebackers that they have with Mayo and Spikes and Hightower. Are you worried about speed at all on that defense or no?
I'm not worried about speed, because one of the things that they haven't had a lot of speed on that defense. I think Hightower is an upgrade at speed. Like you said, they're heavy at that position. You know, Spikes is a big guy, and he's truly an inside linebacker. You're not going to see Spikes lining up outside and dropping back into pass coverage. He's strictly a fill the hole, you know, up the middle defender. Mayo is another guy who they played with, moving around to the outside a little bit once Spikes got more comfortable. you know, this whole thing about the 3-4, 4-3 defense, people talk about it like these teams like are married to these defensive formations and that they don't shift these players around at all, or that they don't ever play with four defensive linemen, which is really not true. Even a 3-4 defense, a lot of times you have a linebacker who's essentially a defensive end. People think you need to have a player who can rush the passer and play pass coverage like a safety to be a great outside linebacker or defensive end in a 3-4, which is totally not the case because of the way that you set your defense to formations. Okay, I would be an example of a guy like that who's at 190 pounds, was playing outside linebacker, quote unquote, but it was also, you know, depending on the formation, had my hand down against an offensive tackle, which is a terrible example of how to play defense. But personnel wise, I think people get a little bit too carried away about finding a true outside linebacker to move into a 3-4 defense and play on that outside. I think you can do a lot of things with your personnel. You know, the Patriots were one of the first teams to use a defense where nobody even lined up at a position whatsoever. What it comes down to now in the NFL, particularly now that offense are going to, you know, 60% pass plays, is matchups, just in the same way that offenses are using tight ends and slot receivers and running backs to get favorable matchups on safeties and linebackers. They're using defensive ends, linebackers, to get favorable matchups against offensive linemen and tight ends, and running backs in blocking situations. So I don't think that it's as big a deal as people are making it out to be. I think that you, in an NFL defense today, you draft athletic, talented players, you know, maybe with the exception of a nose guard or a defensive tackle, defensive ends, linebackers. We're moving towards really a game where those are all interchangeable positions, where you're going to take your inside linebacker on one play and you're going to line them up outside on the next play. And you're going to take a defensive end on one play and you're going to play him at defensive tackle on the next play. Or you're going to play him at inside linebacker, or you're going to drop him back into pass coverage. That's just the nature of the game. I don't think you're going to see a lot of teams who can afford to just line up with the same front seven guys on every single play at, you know, the same seven positions. Because offenses are too good at exploiting that now. And you look at the way that the Patriots use their slot players to exploit defenses and those edge players. You know, defenses try to do that as well with their athletic players and matchups in that respect. And a good defensive coach, a good defensive coordinator can find ways to plug athletic defensive ends, athletic linebackers, into positions where they can be effective with their given skill set. So I don't worry about that so much, maybe as some people are making it out to be a big deal. And you see it like in every draft, right? Like every draft, the 3-4 defense, 4-3 defense, it's all people talk about when a player is picked is whether it's 3-4 or 4-3. I really don't think it makes that much of a difference at the end of the day.
It's all about knowing your assignment and being able to execute.
Exactly. And it's about the coaches to put you in the right position to do your job. You know, obviously if you're a true pass rusher, you know, if your coach is putting you, you know, in a 6 or a 5 and not a 7 or a 9, then you might have issues. But if they know how to use you and know how to move you around and scout your opponent well, I don't think it's that much of an issue. And I think honestly the 4-3, 3-4 thing is a little bit misleading because of the way that a 3-4 shifts based on formation, where most of the time you really have four guys on the line of scrimmage and four guys with line gap responsibilities. So I think that's a little bit of a misconception, and certainly the Patriots, if you watch them, actually play with four defensive linemen quite a bit, personnel wise.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, what I've also been hearing is if they are, you know, I mean, if people are talking about that linebacker core being, you know, the best linebackers on that team being all sort of bigger guys, and, you know, I mean, you're playing the Jets and the Dolphins each twice a year. I mean, those are teams that just run the ball all day. So that's also not necessarily the worst thing in the world to have those type of guys. I guess now just some odds and ends. I mean, one thing I want to talk about is, you know, I have no respect for the Dallas Cowboys whatsoever. I think that they just really don't get it. This is a team that always overspends in free agency. This is a team that moved up in this draft. And I love Maurice Claiborne. I think he's a great player. You know, we had lots of reports on him, and there's nothing but positive there. And I think he can make a big impact for them. But if you look at what the Eagles did and what the Cowboys did, the Eagles moved up in their draft to get Fletcher Cox, who's an absolute monster. They traded away a fourth and a sixth round pick. And, you know, I think to get that guy, that's maybe worth it. The Cowboys moved up to six to get Claiborne. They gave up a second round pick. They traded their 14th pick and a second round pick to move up from 14 to six to get this cornerback. This is a team they spent lots of money in free agency on Brandon Carr. They've got Michael Jenkins already. I don't know. I mean, don't you think that seems like a steep price to give up your first pick and your second pick?
It does. Again, you know, I think we come from the same school of draft philosophy. Certainly the teams that we follow, this doesn't seem like a move that they would make. You know, the Patriots traded out with third round picks in order to move up in the draft. But, you know, at 14, I guess from what everybody was saying, the Cowboys had Claiborne as like the number one or two player on their board. They felt like he was the best player in the draft, yada, yada, yada. Is he that much better than Stephon Gilmore or Dre Kirkpatrick?
No.
Or any of the other top three or four cornerbacks in the game that they could have potentially had at 14. You know, I would agree with you. I don't think so. So I guess you just, that's sort of the nature of the beast, I guess. You know, every year there's going to be players who certain teams are totally enamored with and are willing to do whatever it takes to go up and get them for whatever reason, you know, and I agree with you. That was a steep price to pay.
Yeah, it just seems like they're, you know, and I get the Eagles a little more. Like I said, I mean, Fletcher Cox is a hell of a player. You know, they're giving up fourth and sixth round picks, which I think can be worth it if you're going to get a guy who you think is going to be a blue chipper right away. But, you know, it just seems like both of these teams, they've got this deal going on lately where they're spending in free agency. I mean, Dallas has always done it. You know, moving up in drafts, and to me that just seems like the complete opposite way that you build your team for success. You know, I mean, to be spending in free agency like that is, I don't know. What I might just hate them, and maybe I just want to bring that up that I think it was dumb.
That might have a part. That might be a part of it.
Yeah. But yep. Listen, this is gonna be interesting. I think it's an exciting draft class, this is just the beginning of the off season, man.
I know. It is exciting. Mini camps have been held. We are now entering the dark days of summer. You know, the Celtics are still alive and kicking, but for how long remains to be seen. And then we're pretty much stuck with 3 months of not watching baseball.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
then
it's gonna be rough.
The glorious return of the game we love. So that is exciting. You know, the draft is exciting. It's a little taste of what's to come. Gets you excited. There's nothing, you know, nobody's let us down yet. It's all, everybody that we have in our draft class projects to be a player, a diamond in the rough, a seventh round steal. It's all good right now. Then, you know,
it's true.
None of these dreams that we have been shattered yet, you know. So
this is the best our rosters will ever look to us.
It's exactly true. That's exactly true. This is the time of year when everybody's team is the best team in their division, the best team in their conference. Fortunately, we have to go out there on Sunday and figure it out for real. But
yeah, well, hey,
that's good, man. That was a good recap of the draft. That was good. It's good to be back.
Thanks for making the time, and we'll be back. I mean, we'll do more off-season stuff. You and I are definitely gonna dig in a little bit on the issues of the concussions and the whole Junior Seau thing. So we'll be back. We'll be back. People just need to be on the lookout for us.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, listen, tell your new son that I say hello.
I absolutely will.
And,
yes.
You know, keep dressing him up in the football stuff.
That's one little bit, one day at a time, man. One day at a time.
All right, man. I'll talk to you. Some of those that work forces are the same that burn crosses. Some of those that work forces are the same that burn crosses. Some of those that work forces are the same that burn crosses. Some of those that work forces draw the same that burn crosses. Killing in the name of, killing in the name of. Now you do what they told ya. 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 Those who died are justified. We're wearing the badge, yeah, they're chosen white. To justify those that died. We're wearing the badge, yeah, they're chosen white. Those who died are justified. We're wearing the badge, yeah, they're chosen white. To justify those who died. We're wearing the badge, yeah, they're chosen white. Some of those that work forces are the same that burn crosses. Some of those that work forces are the same that burn crosses. Some of those that work forces are the same that burn crosses. Some of those that work forces are the same that burn crosses. Killing in the name of. Killing in the name of. Now you do what they told you. 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 Justified, we're wearing the badge, they get chosen white. You're justified, those that died, we're wearing the badge, they get chosen white. Those who died are justified, we're wearing the badge, they get chosen white. You're justified, those that died, we're wearing the badge, they get chosen white. Come on.
Do what you tell me. Fuck you, I won't do what you tell me. Fuck you.